You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Now, you may have had this experience at some point in your life, maybe this week. Your friends or acquaintances do something fun, and you hear about it afterward, or maybe you see a post on social media while it's going on. You feel like you missed out. Why are they having fun? Well, you're not. Or you came in late to a hilarious online conversation, or you were the last one to find out about the meme everybody else was talking about. You may be experiencing FOMO, the fear of missing out. This fear of missing out is not a new concept, but has gotten a lot of attention in the social media age. And it can have some effects on our mental health and social interactions. Our next guest has researched the experience in young people and adults. He's here to help us better understand and manage our fear of missing out. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you feel this fear of missing out? Do you feel like you have to be on social media more so you don't miss the important thing? How strongly do you feel it? How do you handle it? Does it affect decisions you make about what to do and when? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Chris Berry is a psychology professor at Washington State University. His lab researches youth behavior and personality. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
I gave some, ideas of what fear of missing out might look like. Do you have kind of a working definition as you do your research into the topic?
You know, I think you gave a lot of really great examples just now. The way we sort of think about it is preoccupation or distress with missing out on activities, especially activities within our own social circle.
And this could happen without social media, but it seems like a lot easier to think about, to worry about when we're on social media a lot. Is that true?
That's right. And we didn't really have a term or a label for this in the psychological research world until about 10 years ago. And it really was because of social media and the availability of those images that we're missing out on. So our friends post a picture of something that they've done or a meal that they've had or an outing or event that they've gone to, and it's readily available for us to see and to realize that we've missed out.
We use FOMO, fear of missing out, maybe a lot on social media and is just kind of a pop culture term. Are there potentially significant consequences for our mental and emotional well-being if we're feeling this a lot in a negative way?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that we've done in my research is look at the apparent impact of social media on adolescents, for example. And we don't really see a one-size-fits-all impact. What we see is that in one of our studies, adolescents with more social media accounts experienced higher rates of anxiety and depression, but only if they also had that fear of missing out. So that fear of missing out in terms of how someone approaches social media and the impact it has on them seems to be a really important variable.
When I think of fear of missing out and heavy social media users, I do think first of younger people. But you did some studies with different age groups trying to dig into this. What did you look at? What did you end up finding?
Yeah, so with the study I just mentioned, I was telling another researcher about it and talking about fear of missing out being a really important factor. And they said to me, well, what do you do about fear of missing out? And I didn't really have an answer for that. And it really got me thinking about what is really behind that. And is it something that we would see primarily in younger people as we might expect? And so the study that we did that you referenced looked at individuals in their teens, another group in their 20s, another group in their 30s, and another group in their 40s. And long story short, we didn't find any age differences in fear of missing out at all. Instead, what we found is that regardless of age, people who tended to have lower self-esteem reported more isolation or loneliness, lower self-compassion, so really having a hard time coping with setbacks, also reported more fear of missing out. So it seems to be more of an individual variable more than just a generational thing or an age thing.
Is there something that sets apart people who might experience this negative fear of missing out if it is an age? Is there something else that might be a warning factor?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the one variable, I mentioned self-compassion, that I think is important. Part of self-compassion is what's known as mindfulness, and it's being in the moment. And so if we're really in the moment, tuned into the people around us, the experiences around us, there's really, in my opinion, less room for missing out. worrying about what we're not doing because we're really immersed in what we are doing.
We're talking about the concept of FOMO, fear of missing out, when we see likely on social media, though not just on social media, like, hey, it seems like everybody else is doing fun stuff and I'm missing out. And maybe if I have serious FOMO going on here, I feel bad about it. Has this happened to you or someone you know? Have you found a way to deal with it? When you look on social media and see all that cool stuff, does it make you feel bad you're not doing all the cool stuff? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, I think sometimes we have conversations where it's, social media is good or social media is bad. But from your research and others, it seems like it could go either way. I could use social media as a tool to arrange that cool stuff, get together with my friends. It could be an avenue for a good social connection, or I could lurk and watch people do fun stuff and feel bad that I'm not out doing it. It's kind of how we use it.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned, yeah, the research findings are really mixed. It's as I mentioned earlier, not a one size fits all piece. So what we really sort of have narrowed in on is someone's mindset. You know, how are they using social media? What are they using it for? If it's causing any kind of distress, are they taking reasonable steps to maybe cut back on it, and really using it as a tool for things that are beneficial?
If we are in that zone where we're using it in that negative way, we're seeing the people post the best, the highlight reels of their lives and comparing our own daily lives to it, how are there thoughts on how we can break out of that?
Yeah, that's a great question and an important one. I think the first step in that is to really tune into, is this something that's really adding to my daily life? Is this something that's beneficial for me? Or is this something that's just really causing me a lot of stress? So I think that's the first step. Another thing that we looked at in some of our research are what's known as protective behavioral strategies. So these are things that are designed to limit the impact of something. And so it really is rooted in the addiction research, actually. So things that people might use to lessen the impact or the harm caused by alcohol use, for example. So using a designated driver is one classic example. So in terms of the social media piece, one of the things that we've had adolescents and young adults tell us in our research that they might do are things like turning off notifications so that we're not getting a notification every time there's a post or someone's messaged us. Turning off the device at night. One of the things that we see with teens over the last decade is that social media and electronic use more broadly negatively impacts sleep. Deleting apps might be a little bit more of a drastic step, but something that some people are willing to do if it's really taking a lot of time. So what are the strategies that someone might use to just lessen the impact?
I've talked to a guest about taking social media Sabbath, picking one day of the week where you don't do any social media. Or I've heard other people say, schedule yourself at whatever, 7 p.m., I'm going to take 20 minutes and catch up on my social media, but I'm not going to keep picking it up through the day. Are those other good strategies?
Absolutely. And I think those are things that are sort of trial and error. And they're sort of, again, not a one size fits all piece, but it's something that someone could really think about as potentially a good fit for them. Those of us who work with teens or young people, I think it's incumbent upon us to just describe those strategies to them, so they're just aware of some of the different things that they might try.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Paul is calling from the Mississippi River. You're out on the river. Is that right, Paul?
Well, we just left the river, but I just heard your story, and I thought I had something to contribute.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Paul?
Well, I'm on the other end of the fear of missing out. I create these events for our summer camp in Wisconsin. The camp's been in existence since 1951, and we do these reunions. And I get calls from kids of kids that went to the summer camp, and they feel bad that they can't come to the reunion. So I have to talk them down sometime, like, you can come to the reunion next year, or study us on the website and keep in touch with us. That makes them feel a little better, especially the kids on social media that really want to participate in this, event. Those who live in Wisconsin may understand the beauty of these summer camps all over the state.
Paul, I want to talk about the connections you have. Now, people had such a great experience with their first outing in this camp program. They want to keep coming back and rekindling those connections year after year?
That's correct. And we meet every year in Waupaca. for this summer camp that closed in 1988, and yet we still go back, many of us, every year to Waupaca. We hang out at the chain of lakes or on Stratton Lake where the camp was, and we get, you know, 10, 15 people. Sometimes we get 70. But I always get these people that say we have a fear of missing out, like we'll never get to go to the camp again.
And Paul, can I ask, how long have you personally been doing this?
Since I was a camper in 1966, and I worked through the ranks like a lot of other people. I came back as a junior counselor, senior counselor, then as a director. And then finally, after the camp closed, I created this group, CampWaupaca.com, and we basically, you know, send pictures and we tell stories about our experiences at camp. And now we have the kids and even the grandkids of campers and staff that went there.
Paul, thanks a lot for sharing that. That's a great story. You may hear more from us. I think we'll want to know more about that. But Chris, I think at the core of the fear of missing out is the worry about, being isolated from people. Paul's experience there at the camp really affirms the value of making those connections. Even if some people worry that they can't make it this year, they have that fear of missing out. I don't know. Could you talk about what you hear in those connections Paul's telling us about?
That's right. I mean, Paul was giving me a little fear of missing out, describing being out on the river this afternoon. I think you know, that sort of fits a point that you made earlier, which is that fear of missing out is I think a part of a human experience in that we want to connect. We don't want to be isolated. And this has been the case since long before social media. The social media makes it a more salient everyday experience. It makes it more obvious what we're missing out on. I suspect with these camp reunions, a lot of the location, time, date, et cetera, are communicated online or through social media too. So it just makes those things that we're missing out on more obvious to us than they might have been in years past. But the key point is that, it's understandable that people experience a fear of missing out because we like to connect with others for the most part.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to psychology professor Chris Berry from Washington State University, looking at the idea of FOMO, the fear of missing out, how to manage it. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this feeling yourself? What gives you the fear of missing out? Do you think social media or other technology is contributing to your FOMO or in general in our society? Join in at 800-642-1234. Or have you found a way to overcome that? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Chris Berry, psychology professor at Washington State University, who researches youth behavior and personality. He's with us today to explore how we're affected by the fear of missing out, FOMO, and what we can do when we feel it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you had this maybe while looking at social media? Everybody's doing cool stuff that I am missing out on. Do you still feel that way? Did you get over it in some way? Did it inspire you to do more stuff with people? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Chris, I wonder if this is a variety of fear of missing out. The idea that, when we do something fun and cool, if I'm out with friends at a restaurant or bar or whatever, then I might take a picture, put it on social media. If I'm at home eating pretzels, watching a Gilligan's Island marathon, I'm probably not going to post that. So then when you go and look at social media, everybody's posting their best stuff on there, but you compare it to your daily life that, you know, there's some fun stuff, but it isn't always that way. Do we kind of compare our daily lives with that best of reel we're getting on social media all the time?
Right. It's a really important point too. You know, I've heard many people say that what you're seeing on social media is essentially a highlight reel from people. And certainly some people decide that a lot of experiences that they have are worth highlights. And so they post those, and some people may be more hesitant to do so. Yeah, I mentioned the sleep issue earlier. The other thing that we see consistently in the research in terms of potential negative impacts of social media, and again, there are some positives that appear to be the case, are those social comparisons. And so I think especially as these platforms were becoming more widespread and more commonly used, it was natural to start to engage in a lot of social comparisons that we would not have made if we'd not seen these posts on social media. But again, it's important to keep in mind that we're seeing the best case scenario in most cases from the people that we follow.
A lot of your research works with younger people. Maybe their first experience is getting into social media. Do you have thoughts on how, you know, we can prepare kids to recognize that this is the way things work and not be overwhelmed by the fear of missing out?
It is a great question as well. And I think part of it is, or part of the challenge is that these platforms are constantly changing and evolving and emerging. And so the things that teens used 5 years ago have changed to new platforms now. And so part of the challenge for parents, for example, is to just be aware of what's out there and what's popular among teens. I think the other part is to really stress the message that even though social media can be a useful tool for a lot of reasons, they're not, I think, best thought of as replacing those face-to-face or direct interactions with peers. And so to really encourage those opportunities as well.
Talking about the idea of FOMO, the fear of missing out, with Chris Berry, psychology professor at Washington State University. He's done some research on this. We heard from Paul and Phillips, who couldn't stay on the line but wanted to bring up the other side. JOMO, joy of missing out. Paul told us there's so many things to do at this point in my life. A lot I see has been there, done that. I'm on to doing other things. Chris, people have talked about this idea that, like, hey, I feel good. There's too much stuff out there. I like having a break from it. You tried to look into this idea of the joy of missing out. Is it a thing?
Yeah, we tried to, as you said. Yeah. So the thing about joy of missing out that we had in mind was that, exactly as you said, that there may be times where it's just good to disconnect, that disconnection can be rejuvenating, can be refreshing to us. And we've probably all experience that from time to time. What we found when we tried to measure JOMO, to get people to sort of reflect on their experiences, is we ended up finding unexpectedly that people who reported joy of missing out, a lot of them also reported a lot of social anxiety and loneliness. And so part of what we were capturing unintentionally was that some people enjoy missing out because social interactions for them are really stressful or anxiety provoking, which was not what we were trying to get at. What we were trying to get at is the enjoyment of just disconnecting, of having those periods of solitude that where we can sort of self-reflect and like I said, get rejuvenated. So we do see some people who are reporting that, and also reporting not as much anxiety and greater life satisfaction. But the other thing, I guess, bottom line that I would say about that is that JOMO is probably best understood as sort of short periods of time where we like to sort of decompress, turn things off, disconnect. But then as human beings, most of us still want to reconnect with other people and stay connected.
Yeah, a lot of this sounds really high tech, things we do on social media, but it speaks to, you know, maybe something fundamental about us as social animals. Is fear of missing out just part of an expression of our basic need to connect with other humans?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that we weren't really forced to think about it in the way that we've been talking about until social media put the missing out kind of right in our pockets.
What are you looking at next when it comes to researching these ideas of missing out on other things and how we relate to it?
So the next step we're in the process of developing is to revisit the concept of JOMO, or joy of missing out, but to look at it not as sort of a personality trait that people have, but to look at it in terms of periods throughout the day that people are experiencing greater solitude. And are they also experiencing some sort of relief or some sort of greater sense of calm at those times? So what we're going to do with that study is to have people sort of reflect on their mental state, their disconnection or connection regarding others multiple times a day over the course of a week to really see the more moment-to-moment changes in connection with others, and is that a good thing or not a good thing?
Having studied this so closely yourself, does this change the way you think about how you use social media to connect to other people?
Absolutely, and I think the challenge is to not try to not be hypocritical about it, or to actually learn from what we're doing. And so I do think that, you know, I've found myself being more mindful about my interface with social media. Is it beneficial? In what ways is it beneficial? Am I getting really upset about seeing some posts? Maybe it's a political thing or whatever. And in those situations, maybe disconnecting or turning it off.
And how about your students as you talk to them about it? How do they reflect on these issues?
They're just a fountain of information, as you might imagine. Just their sophistication with these platforms is really high. And I think they have a pretty strong sense of how people express themselves in these platforms and how that's changed. And so one of the things that students continue to tell me is that there's a difference between seeing posts that are more visual or photo-based and those that are more text-based. And so the photo-based is just a quicker hit. It often sort of engenders that fear of missing out more quickly than just reading someone's tweet or Facebook post, for example, that's a lot of words.
Interesting. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
That's Chris Berry, psychology professor at Washington State University. His lab researches youth behavior and personality. He's with us today to talk about the fear of missing out and how to handle it. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. First, if you're a frequent or even occasional viewer of Fox News, you're probably familiar with this type of commercial.
You invested in the stock market? In our world of fake news, here's what they're not telling you. Gold has outperformed the Dow for the past 17 years. That's the real news. Numbers don't lie. In the year 2000, if you invested $100,000 in the Dow, it would be worth about $197,000 today. But had you diversified just 20% of that into gold, your investment would be worth $248,000, 26% more. Call Lear Capital, the leader in precious metals investing with over 20 years' experience and $2 billion in trusted transactions.
According to an analysis by the Washington Post, ads like this one from Los Angeles-based Lear Capital are a mainstay on not just Fox News, but also Newsmax, as well as podcasts featuring Republican Senator Ted Cruz from Texas and Rudy Giuliani. They didn't find any similar ads appearing on mainstream or left-leaning media. Lear is just one of many companies that target older viewers with pitches to invest retirement savings in their unique gold coins. But the investigation found that would-be investors paid high premiums for the products, in some cases leading to big losses in their retirements. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered those advertisements before? Where did you see them? Did they inspire you to invest in gold and these kind of gold coins in particular? Do you have a relative who paid attention to these ads and invested money for better or worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jeremy Merrill is a data reporter for The Washington Post, focusing on technology. His new piece he co-authored for The Post is called How Right-Wing News Powers the Gold IRA Industry. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
What led you to dig into this story of these gold coins advertised so heavily on certain media outlets?
That's a great question. This actually started several years ago. As was mentioned, I focus on technology primarily, and I was looking at political ads on Facebook. you ordinarily expect to see politicians asking you for donations. You expect to see outside groups saying, hey, you should change your views on this issue. You expect to see people selling merchandise. And then I was just really puzzled to see ads on Facebook targeting people who were 59 years old or older, and targeting people specifically who were politically conservative, people who were Republicans, people who were fans of Sean Hannity, that sort of thing. With ads, you know, they didn't have the name of a company. It was just saying, hey, join this webinar to learn how to protect your retirement from the Democrats' coming retirement kill switch, or something sort of overheated like that. It just sort of stuck in my craw. Like, what is this? It was confusing. I went down the rabbit hole and found this company called metals.com. Around the time we were looking into them, so were regulatory officials in a bunch of states saying their investors had been allegedly defrauded. They had put in hundreds of thousands of dollars and gotten gold and silver coins that were worth a lot less.
Let's talk
after about we did a story on that in 2019. I started getting emails and phone calls from people saying, hey, it's not just that one company. This is a whole industry.
And let's talk, Jeremy, about what this, how this industry works. Now, when people talk about investing in gold, they might be buying, you know, gold futures where they never actually handle a piece of metal on their own. That's not the case with these so-called gold IRA companies. If I decide, hey, this advertisement sounds boffo, I want to invest, what happens? What do I get?
That's exactly right. Think about sort of ordinary choices might be to invest in stocks or bonds or mutual funds. If you're really into gold and silver, you can buy mining stocks or gold futures. Those are all options. You've also separately got people who are investing, so to speak, by collecting rare coins that really do have some historical value that they think, you know, someone's going to want this 1897, whatever. But what they're buying there is something that has some collectible value. That's not what we're talking about here. With the gold IRA industry, most of these companies are selling what are called bullion coins, which means the coins get their value from being made out of gold or being made out of silver. And they don't have any sort of special historical value. In many cases, they happen to be made by the government of Canada, of all places, which sells bullion coins that are well known, called maple leafs, as well as some weirder ones that have polar bears or other sort of Canadian wildlife on them.
And you talk...
There's nothing...
I want to get a case of like where this can go wrong. You talked to a guy named Ed DeSanto, 65-year-old, you describe him as a semi-retired Florida medical coder, identifies as politically conservative. He puts $100,000 into gold and silver in these coins. How much value in gold and silver did he end up getting?
What he ended up getting in terms of the weight of gold and silver he got was worth only $52,000, which is a big loss. You know, he invested in 2019, which turns out to have been, you know, if you had the power of hindsight, actually a pretty good time to buy gold and silver because the prices have gone up since then. Mm-hmm. You know, the price of gold and silver, it goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down, much like any other, anything else that you could invest in. But relative to 2019, the prices are higher now than they were then. But for his $100,000 investment, he cashed out a lot of it this spring. He still lost money, despite the fact that the market had gone up more than 30%. And that's in large part due to the commissions that he was charged by American Hartford Gold Group, the company that he invested with.
Talking to Jeremy Merrill with the Washington Post about his reporting on what's called the gold IRA industry. They advertise heavily on more conservative media, in some cases direct email and phone. You can join in by phone at 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We won't buy your gold, but we want to hear your stories. Tom joins us in Oxford. Tom, hi.
Well, good afternoon. I'm actually not selling my gold, but I have a little of it advice on these companies. The first is, if they're trying to sell you an IRA, keep in mind, you do not take physical possession of the gold. They are storing it for you in a vault someplace far away. And frankly, do you even know that they put the gold in the vault? It is stay away in capital letters. If you want to invest in physical gold, the best move you can make is to visit a city with a United States mint. West Point, New York, Washington, D.C. for the headquarters building, Philadelphia, Denver, San Francisco, you can buy gold bullion coins literally at minimal markup. You know, they put it in a velvet case. And there's also no tax because you're buying it at a federal facility. And the coins that they want to sell you, they may be rare, but they're very often graded coins by a third party that have done their examination. It's PCGS and NGC, but ultimately you're buying a coin in a sealed plastic slab.
Tom, I got you. Gave us a lot to talk about there. First of all, Jeremy, I was a little confused about this. They call it gold IRAs, but a lot of these companies actually do provide you. You do end up with these coins. And I had thought, like Tom did, that if we're calling it an IRA, they'd be storing gold somewhere for you. Are both of these things happening?
In many of these cases, the gold is stored at a third-party depository, basically a bank. And so, you know, in many cases, you know, and in the cases of the companies that we discuss in my article, the gold and silver, they really do exist. And there's just this question over whether the customers really understood what they were getting. You know, the companies say their disclosure practices are all totally legal. The customers say they were shocked when they figured out what they had actually gotten. But there have been, as the caller noted, some instances, you know, including in the past year and, you know, going back probably as far back as, you know, ancient Babylonia, of cases where people thought they were buying gold and it didn't really exist. It wasn't really in the vault. So there's all sorts of shenanigans that can take place. But in this case, yeah, a lot of people are using this, you know, totally legal, but kind of obscure practice to invest from their retirement savings in these products.
And Tom also mentioned, you know, if you really want to have gold coins in your possession, there are ways, or gold in whatever form, there are ways to buy it. And you have a follow-up piece with advice for experts. There are ways to buy it without these massive markups?
Right. You know, don't go out there and think that I'm saying you ought to do this or that you ought not do this. You just ought to be careful if you've already decided, hey, that's a good idea. A lot of financial advisors say investing in gold and silver is a terrible idea. Some say it's an okay idea, or even a good idea, as long as you limit it to a pretty small slice of your portfolio. But what I think everybody agrees on is that you want to minimize the amount of money that you pay to some salesman on the phone, and maximize the amount of money that you spend on actual gold or silver. Maximize the amount of money you spend on the thing that you want and minimize the transaction costs. There are certainly reputable online dealers and reputable local coin stores where people can sort of minimize the amount of markup, or it's also called spread or premium, that they pay, which of course maximizes the amount of money you get worth of gold and silver.
Tom, thanks again for that call. We're talking to Jeremy Merrill, data reporter for The Washington Post, looking at a recent analysis he did looking at gold investment advertising on especially conservative media sources, as well as Facebook and elsewhere. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you encountered this, either the ads, maybe a hard sell email, or even phone call or a series of phone calls? Do you have questions about how this all works? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Jeremy Merrill with the Washington Post, looking at so-called gold IRA companies that pitch unique gold coins as a retirement investment vehicle, often featuring very high markups for the precious metal, gold or silver in some cases, that you actually get. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or stories. Back to your calls now. Randy is with us in Madison. Randy, hi.
Good afternoon. I've learned a couple things from some recent public broadcasting pieces, PBS and NPR. And the big takeaways for me were that, as you mentioned, if you see one of those commercials, you're watching a conservative station. And you won't find them on regular ones. The other is that pretty much the standard commission fee is one third. And a lot of people, when they get, when these, sellers, get their hands around them, so to speak, they will, divert their attention from that, and these guys will buy that not even knowing that they're losing a third there.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. And Jeremy, you reached out to some of these companies to ask about that, you know, the transparency of these fees, whether the buyers really know what they're getting into. What kind of things did you hear or not hear, as the case may be?
Yeah, Randy's exactly right that a lot of the companies, they'll say somewhere in their transaction agreements that people sign. Sometimes they're more transparent about it. Sometimes it's less, depends on the company, that they're going to charge 33% or 35%. Sometimes it just says up to 35% without actually saying the exact amount that you're being charged. The companies tend to say that their disclosures are legally adequate, that this is what they're required to do, and they do it. This has come into some question as regulators from almost every state and two federal regulatory authorities have sued five or so of these gold IRA companies, all based around Los Angeles, and said that, you know, the those disclosures aren't adequate because the customers are confused. And in some cases, that they're actually charging far more than that one third. One company is was alleged to have charged more than 200% as a markup for some of their coins, which is really quite a bit if you're thinking about what you'd get if you were investing your retirement savings.
Thanks a lot for that call. Patrick joins us now in Madison. Patrick, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What do you want to bring up, Patrick?
So there are two things I want to bring up. The first is I'm only 23, but I've been a lifelong numismatist, and seeing scams related to coins is not at all surprising to me. You don't have to shake a stick very far online to find coins that are worth $20, $30 being sold for $80. So this, it being gold, is just the special thing, I guess. The other thing is that I'm not surprised that it's being marketed towards right-leaning people. There are a lot of people who are interested in precious metals who also are, shall we say, conspiratorially minded, that believe that the Federal Reserve is some sort of ploy to financially enslave the American people or something like that. So seeing that advertised more to more conservative leaning people isn't a big surprise to me either.
Patrick, thanks for that call. And Jeremy, you point out that often when we go back like to the Glenn Beck show and things like that, you might have a feature on the show about how the economy was about to collapse, you better get gold, and then a gold ad right after that.
That's exactly right. You know, this the linkage between the political right wing and the idea of gold as offering a particular kind of security goes back decades, if not centuries. But it's a linkage that is especially strong today. You'll see, as we talk about in the piece, if you watch a Trump rally on Newsmax, sometimes half the screen while Trump is talking is taken up with an ad for American Hartford Gold, which is one of these companies. A lot of the email news alerts you get from Newsmax are, again, ads for gold IRA companies that are politically themed. The ads aren't saying, hey, you should buy our gold. It's got the pricing is good. It says, for instance, This is Biden and Yellen's secret plan to steal your hard-earned money and bail out their Wall Street buddies, was another ad. When we asked Hartford Gold about where they advertise, they say they advertise where it brings, where they believe it will create the most value.
Thanks a lot for that call. Carl is with us next in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Carl, hi.
Hi, I had started a gold IRA in 2011. And anyway, the fees increased every year. And at age 59, I was able to withdraw. So it was the Canadian gold pieces, but I had a 100-ounce bar of silver, unstamped and unmarked. And it was out of this outfit called Swiss America in Phoenix.
Hey, Carl, were you able to do something with that unmarked silver? Were you able to convert that into money to buy goods and services?
It's not stamped. It's not certified.
Interesting. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Jeremy, have you run into any stories like that?
I've heard of that company. I don't know a ton about them. If you want to send me an email, I'll happily hear more about it to the caller. But, you know, this is an industry that has existed for quite a long time. What we wrote about may sort of be the most recent iteration. As you mentioned earlier, there was a blow up about this in around 2011. On the one side, you had Representative Anthony Weiner, who was sort of making political hay about Glenn Beck, who was then a Fox News broadcaster, who had really close ties to a company called Goldline. Goldline's still in business, but they were charged with a variety of sort of misdeeds related to people buying gold back then in 2011. The case settled without them admitting any sort of wrongdoing. They said their business practices were fully transparent. But a lot of their employees soon went elsewhere. And many of them founded the companies that still exist today, including Hartford Gold that we've talked about a lot here, and Metals.com, the company I mentioned at the top of the hour, who advertised on Facebook. That company was raided by the FBI in 2020 and is no longer in business.
Thanks a lot for sharing that experience, Carl. In our last minute, Jeremy, as I mentioned, you had a follow-up piece where you talked to people, some experts about advice. One thing that seemed to be consistent from experts is, you know, if somebody's pressuring you on the phone to buy these things, if somebody's using scare tactics, that's a sign to take a closer look and back away. Can you give a sense of the sort of things that experts told you about these things? With the disclaimer, as you mentioned earlier, neither you nor I are investment advisors.
Right. I mean, that's the first thing to do is to make sure that this is the choice you want to be making. Don't fall for someone's marketing as far as what you ought to be doing with your investment, because it's your retirement savings. That's really important. You're depending on that. This is some of the best advice I heard was actually from Leslie Van Buskirk, who is the administrator of the Division of Securities there in Wisconsin at the Department of Financial Institutions. She was pointing out that every dealer charges some sort of markup because they have to pay their rent. Some of the, you know, reputable dealers charge a relatively small markup. It's far, far, far higher than you're going to see on stocks and bonds in general. But it's much smaller than some of these gold IRA companies have allegedly charged. And so what you need to do is figure out for whatever that someone is proposing to sell you, how much you could sell it for to someone else. Not how much the salesman says he might buy it back for later, but how much you could sell it for tomorrow at a local coin store in the town, you know, two towns away down the freeway, in case you needed to cash out, because that's how much it's actually worth.
Jeremy, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yep, thanks for having me.
That's Jeremy Merrill, data reporter at the Washington Post. We talked to him today about targeted gold investment advertising on multiple forms of conservative media and on Facebook. We've got a link to his reporting at WPR.org/Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. After a warm spell in Wisconsin, it cooled off again, enough to need our winter hats. Or you could try a hat alternative like one city did earlier this month, underwear. As reported by the Chicago Tribune's network of papers, the St. Louis City Museum held an event to set the new world record for the most people wearing underwear on their head. According to Guinness, they succeeded with 355 people gathered with, yes, underwear on their heads. The underwear itself was new and provided by the museum. The event went along with an exhibit at the museum on the science of Guinness World Records. They broke the previous record set by Naperville, Illinois. That record was 270 people, timed with the release of a book in the Captain Underpants series. Sometimes when I see these records set, I think Wisconsin should get into the competition. This one, I say, let's stick with hats on our heads. Semper Ubi, Sub Ubi, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest has spent most of her professional and retired career trying to better understand single people in a society and culture that has for generations largely normalized and promoted people partnering up as the ideal way of living. She's been on a mission to get people to reinvent how they think and talk about living single. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you single? Is it by choice? How's being single been good for you, for your life? Were you partnered before, made a choice to become and stay single? And if you're single, what do you hear from other people? Do you get pressure to not be single soon or in the distant future? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Bella DiPaolo has researched and written about single people for decades. She writes the long-running Living Single blog for Psychology Today. She's an academic affiliate in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara. She gave a very popular TEDx talk called What No One Ever Told You About People Who Are Single. Her newest book is called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Bella, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I love talking about this.
I can tell. Now, you reference your origin story, a specific day, December 17th, 1992, that you decided, hey, I'm going to switch what I work on and start studying single people. Why does that day turn into such a pivot point for you?
Yes, it was around the holidays, and there was an advice column in my local newspaper, and it was from someone who was widowed and sad to be alone during the holidays, and the advice columnist wrote a whole answer, and I underlined one sentence: remember that one is a whole number. Now, I didn't feel like I wasn't whole because I was single, but I thought it was really interesting that people would have that assumption that, oh, you need to be reassured that you're a whole person because you're single. Where did that come from? So I started keeping notes and files of all these different kinds of evidence of how people treat single or single people or think about them. Remember the Kathy cartoons from a long time ago? She was always saying, heck, you know, that's single. But even prestigious publications like the New Yorker and the New York Times were publishing comments about single people that were just disparaging. So at an event, at a social event one time, I went up to someone who I knew was single, but I didn't know her very well. And I said, have you ever had the experience of people like treating you differently because you're single? Like for me, for example, the person organizing the class schedule said she wanted me to come in at night because it would be too hard for the married faculty. And this was before any of them even had kids. Well, this other person said, oh, yes. And she started telling me her stories. Then other people joined the group and they started telling their stories. And we talked all night. And then I opened my email the next day and I had emails from some of them and they said, oh, and another thing. So it was clear. This is something that resonates. And I'm an academic, I'm a professor, but a retired professor, but you know, I realized this is something I want to get out there beyond just the halls of academia. This is something that people without higher degrees care about a lot.
Now, you formed this concept, that's also the title of your book, coincidentally, of somebody being single at heart, based not just on your experience, but on survey data and interview data with people around the world in many cases. What do we mean by single at heart?
Yes, people who are single at heart love being single. They want to be single. They're choosing it. They want to stay single. They are happy and flourishing because they are single, not in spite of it. Single life is a better life for them. It's their most meaningful, fulfilling, satisfying, and joyful life.
And you hear again and again the negatives, the yeah buts. And I think one of the top ones is going to be, yeah, but if you're not lonely now, you're going to be someday. This is something that, and this is not just you have heard this. A lot of the people you talk to have heard this. What is the response to that?
Oh, this is some of my favorite data. Sure, that's the stereotype. You poor thing, you think you're happy now. Just wait till you grow older. Well, there are now several studies, big national studies, following people, single people over the course of their lives. And they find, first of all, at every age from 20 to 96, they are on the happy side of the scale. And as they approach midlife and onto later life, they just keep getting happier and happier with their lives. And the people who want to be single, who are not looking for a partner, are becoming even happier. And one of the reasons the single at heart people are doing so well in later life is that they cherish solitude. They savor it. They're not afraid of being alone. And because they appreciate the time they have to themselves and they're comfortable with them, with it, that protects them from being lonely. It got us all through the worst of the pandemic. And it means that as we grow older, and I'm 70, by the way, as we grow older, we are very unlikely to become that stereotypical older person who feels isolated and lonely. That's not who we are. And one of the reasons we're not is because we have been tending to our friends and the people we care about all along. You know, there's this thing that some coupled people do, not all of them, but research shows that on average, when people who are coupled move in together or they get married, they become more insular. They kind of, their life becomes all about each other. And they do this even if they don't have kids. And so they're demoting their friends from dinner to lunch or, you know, weekend plays to plays for their kids give at their schools. Whereas single people and people who are single at heart and want to stay single, they don't do that. They're tending to the people in their lives who matter to them. And so those people are still there for them later in their life. Whereas the people who got married and then put their friends on the back burner, and again, not all married people do that. When they get divorced or widowed, wow, they are, then they're stuck. It's like they believe those song lyrics, "You are my everything. I just want to be your everything." But if that's true, then when you're divorced or widowed, you've got nothing.
Talking to Bella DiPaolo about her new book, Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Sandy is with us in Mineral Point. Sandy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I am one of those single at heart people because I enjoy being single. I enjoy the freedom. I enjoy my friends. And despite the societal norms that have pushed on me always to get married and have kids, is like, now I'm just not that interested.
Sandy, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Bella, Sandy mentioned two key F words there. Friends, you were just talking about that, and freedom. And then when you've talked to people and surveyed people about the values that make them happy to be single, that word freedom seems to come up an awful lot.
It did. When I ask people who are single at heart to tell me their life stories, and I ask them, what do you like about being single? Every one of them said freedom.
What is it about that value of freedom that is such a motivator for people who are single at heart?
I think what happens is that people who are single at heart use their freedom to pursue their interests and their values and to build a life that reflects who they are authentically. There are big studies based on hundreds and thousands of people from, I think, about 31 European nations that look at how much people value freedom and creativity and trying new things. And people who value freedom are happier, whether they're married or single. But the single people value it more and they get more out of it. So freedom makes single people even happier than it makes married people.
Thanks again for that call, Sandy. We're talking to Bella DiPaolo, an expert on single life who writes the Living Single blog at Psychology Today. We're talking about her new book. It's called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for our guest? Are you single at heart yourself? Does that concept make sense to you? Does it make sense to other people in your life, or do you get a lot of pushback? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with single life expert Bella DiPaolo, author of several books and the Living Single blog for Psychology Today. Her newest book is called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Themes about how we think about single people come up a lot in pop culture. Here's a listen to the TV show 30 Rock, Alec Baldwin's character Jack Donaghy questioning Tina Fey's Liz Lemon.
Do you agree that you need someone in your life, Lemon?
No, I have bigger things to worry about than my personal life.
I would think that a single woman's biggest worry would be choking to death alone in her apartment. I have a friend in town I'd like to set you up with.
No, thank you.
Thomas is very bright, has a wonderful sense of humor. I think it's a good match. Are you free on Thursday?
No, Thursday is poker night. And by the way, it is completely inappropriate for you to be questioning me about my private life and then trying to set me up with someone when you don't even know anything about me.
Poker night, who plays?
Really? That's all you got out of that?
All right, Bella, first of all, the helpful friend, or in this case, coworker or boss, who's going to set you up with somebody because you need somebody. A common situation for the single at heart?
Yes, that was such a great clip. Thank you. And the assumptions behind that are just appalling, you know, that she needs someone that she needs to be fixed up as if she's broken, as if she doesn't have a life that's full and fulfilling and joyful and a life that she chose. And those kinds of assumptions come up all the time. And for people who are not just single, but single at heart and love their single lives and want to stay single, in a way, it's even worse because people just, they can't fathom that. And so they'll say to us, oh, you just think that now, you'll get over it, or you just haven't met the right person. It's like they can't accept our own reports of how we feel, what we think about our lives. They think they know what's good for us better than we do. It's amazing. I mean, no one would ever say to a married person, oh, you know, you just think you like being married. Wait a few years, you'll get over it. You just don't know how to do single life.
And actually, the thing that pointed me toward that clip was the bit about, you know, you should be worried about choking to death alone in your apartment. There's a section in your book where this is a common objection. Like, hey, when you're older, you're going to need that significant other to help watch for your health.
Right. And what I say in the book is you're better off with a medical alert device, because if you have a spouse, you know, they might be at work or doing errands or traveling. And if you have a medical alert device, you know, it's always there. So get that. And you know that famous ad, oh, I've fallen, I can't get up. You know who that was? That was a Mrs. Where was her husband?
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Juneau. Jim, hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call.
What do you want to tell us about?
About four years back, I broke up with a girlfriend, and, you know, it hurt at first, and I was kind of lost a little bit. But a little bit into that, I asked myself the question of exactly what I had lost. And to be honest, ever since then, I realized that I am a lot more stress-free without a relationship than I ever was able to be when I had a relationship. And I'm actually being a big part of my grandkids' lives now, which is much more important to me than, you know, trying to start up a new relationship.
So you're going to stick with it? Is that the plan, Jim? You're single at heart now?
Don't get me wrong. I date and stuff, but, you know, I at the end of the day, you know, if I'm not looking for something to, you know, fix my life, I'm happy with my life finally.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Bella, that matches up with, I think, many of the stories you share in the new book.
It does. And what's wonderful about this story is that he is showing that he values relationships, but not just in the narrow, stingy sense of the word, when we use relationships to mean just romantic relationships. He cares about his grandkids and he understands their value. And that's one of the real strengths of people who are single at heart. A lot of people think, oh, if you're single, your life is more limited. But if you're single at heart, it's just the opposite, because we don't buy into the idea that there's only one kind of relationship that counts, or that love only comes in the romantic variety, or that family only is the people that are traditionally defined as family. We might have close friends that we consider family. We understand that intimacy could include sexual intimacy, but it also includes emotional intimacy. And all of those examples are reasons why single life can be so fulfilling.
Jim, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Bella DiPaolo about her new book, Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Back to your calls. Fred is with us in Adams County. Fred, hi.
Good afternoon, Public Radio. Look, I've been I'm in my early 80s. I've been single for 30 years. I'll tell you, it's tough out there for women. I'll tell you what, most women, I'm working class kind of guy. They're lonesome. They're looking for a man. They're looking for somebody to fix their car. And I mean, when I got divorced for a big, large corporation in 1991, the women came out of the woodwork. I could have been married many times. I like women and everything, but this lady talks like she's in love with herself, and that's wonderful. But I'll tell you, women, they're competing for men out there, even at my age. Talk about...
Gotcha. Fred, thanks a lot for the call. Now, Bella, you are very clear in the book. Single life is happy for people who are, as you define it, single at heart. All those lessons don't apply if somebody's single but genuinely wants to be in a partnership of some sort.
Sure. The biggest lesson of my book isn't just that we should respect and value and validate people who are single and want to be single, but that everyone should get to live the life that is best for them. So many people are what you might call coupled at heart. They're powerfully drawn to single life, and they should be valued and validated too. But the thing is, they already are. You know, they don't need any extra pats on the head or rewards or valuing. They already got that.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to talk a little bit about pop culture, Bella, because if we started listening movies where our hero starts off single at the beginning and ends up happily married or, you know, on the way at the end, we could talk all day. I try to think of movies where somebody starts off single and they end up being single and realizing they're really happy being single. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. My list is zero. They're probably out there. That message is so powerful in our popular culture.
You're right. It's so rare. And everybody is missing out when that happens. First of all the people who love being single are missing out on seeing themselves represented in popular culture. And it's sad for people watching it who aren't single at heart, who aren't going to understand that for some people, single life is their best life. And these script writers are missing out on great opportunities. I mean, imagine if they came up with a show in which they show what single at heart people are thinking that they typically only say to themselves. That's hilarious. Like, imagine what they're thinking when a group of people are together and one of them says, "Oh, I just got engaged," and shows the engagement ring and everybody squeals with joy. The single at heart people are really going to have a field day with that. Or, I mean, if you remember back Sex and the City, there's this famous scene where the four women are at a wedding and the bouquet gets tossed and they all look at it and watch it and let it drop in front of them. And then they turn around and walk away and go to brunch together. I mean, I just love that.
Just in our last minute or so, Bella, when somebody confronts that question in a judgy way, why are you still single? The advice is don't ask that question. But for the person who's asked that question, a thought for a response that doesn't involve fisticuffs.
Right. You know, I like to be straightforward and say I love being single and I don't ever want to be anything else. But you can also ask what Chris Marsh suggests this in her great book. She asks, why do you ask that? And if you keep asking that, they will realize what an inappropriate question it is.
Bella, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Bella DiPaolo, expert on single life, who writes the Living Single blog for Psychology Today. She's an academic affiliate in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at the University of California, Santa Barbara. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Single at Heart, The Power, Freedom, and Heart-Filling Joy of Single Life. Still time for you to share your thoughts, your experiences. You can email ideas@wpr.org, or you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page.